Hello, everyone. Welcome to the AI podcast. My name is Athir Ghatami, and my special guest today is Anastasia Varava, who is research lead at SEBX, SE Banken. Welcome, Anastasia.
Thank you so much for having
me. Great to have you here. How did your day start?
Fantastic. It's the first thing I'm doing today, and it's a fantastic start of the day.
Wonderful. So, Anastasia, tell us, what is AI?
I will choose my preferred definition, which is like very close to the original one. It's a computer system that is able to perform tasks, a broad range of tasks that human perform at the level that it is at least comparable to the human level and ideally outperforms it. So it's a very vague definition.
Yes, it is a broad topic, so it deserves a broad definition.
Crucially, it's not supposed to be intelligent. It's about performance. It's not about the way it does it.
All right. So you are a part-time researcher, if not full-time, I would say, since you are at a bank, so I guess you also have some other stuff to do. But tell us about what you do, both research-wise and how you apply AI at the SEBanken.
Yeah, exactly. So I kind of work in the intersection of very applied research that is close to what can bring value to the bank and actual research, which is what I'm doing in academia. So I actually split my time between being faculty at KTH and research lead at SEBX, which is my main job. And my background is actually in robotics and AI. So I got my PhD in computer science some years back from KTH. So on the KTH side, I continue doing research in machine learning primarily, both from the more theoretical perspective, which is like geometric methods in machine learning for representation learning, and on the applied side, which is more about how do we apply this to robotic tasks. And at SEB, this is more about several innovations to do, and we're interested in how new technology can change the way banking does business in general on the scale for up to 10 years. So we have a broad portfolio of cases that we work with. And the most here and now, for the past year, of course, it was accelerating adoption of generative AI, which is, I guess, what everyone has been doing for the past year. And now we're kind of done with that, and we're trying to move to new cases that we're going to focus on. Mm-hmm. But it's really about applying state-of-the-art technology in AI for business-relevant problems.
So what are the business-relevant problems? What are the use cases that you're looking at?
There are kind of four different areas that we, or aspirational goals, so to say, that we broadly identified. One is probably the most obvious one. It's increasing employees' efficiency. So it's everything that has to do with helping our colleagues to reduce time they spend on routine tedious, boring tasks to help them be more creative. So to really kind of enable them to use AI as a tool that can just make their job better. And generative AI obviously is an excellent tool for that because, of course, it has limitations. And we kind of wanted to start with having a human in the loop always. So that's why we started targeting systems that are facing our employees and not kind of end customers. The other kind of big area is how AI can allow you to do your job better, not just by reducing time that you spend on boring tasks, but really by making better decisions. So how can you derive more insights from the data and potentially do some prediction as well to just make better decisions when it comes to investment, risk assessment, trading, like all of those kind of sorts of things? How can you understand financial markets better? How can you potentially simulate them? How can you model this really complex dynamical systems? The third application is, of course, how we can foresee and prevent crime. And this is both financial crime and cyber attacks. And that's another very, very important area because obviously the criminals are not waiting for AI to be properly regulated. So like we foresee that there's going to be an ongoing race between, so to say, the good guys and the bad guys. So it's very important to look into that area. And of course, customer experience. So everything that has to do with just making the experience of our customers, both private and corporate, better by giving them more insights, making the services more personalized and so on.
Sure. Actually, I fully understand the concepts, and I think these are widely defined concepts, but I would really like to get some concrete use cases. I mean, the predictive financial market behavior, right? Fine, financial crime could be like anti-money laundering. That's also an example. But I'm interested in understanding some of the examples when it comes like increasing the productivity or efficiency of employers. So what are the use cases you got there?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a lot of manual processes at the bank that have to do with reading lots of internal documents or specific websites and answering questions, all sorts of questions based on those. And that takes a lot of time. So what we did for the past year is we basically built virtual assistants based on large language models that help our employees to quickly find answers to these questions, which, again, I think is a very common topic when it comes to generative AI applications. So it's something that is called retrieval augmented generation. And we did this for many parts of the business. So we did it, for example, for customer support. So not facing the customer, but really helping the employees of customer support to find answers to questions. We had a case with compliance advisors. So also finding answers to questions that compliance advisors get. We did this for financial analysts who work with financial research reports, which are much more complex documents. They combine text, tables, and so on and so forth. And the questions there are also kind of trickier. So it's a full range of this kind of things. And then, of course, if you move beyond question answering, it's all the obvious applications of generative AI, right? Like it's drafting emails, like the kind of stuff that can be handled by off-the-shelf tools, essentially. So you don't really need much customization there, but it's still extremely important.
Right.
To actually have this.
That's actually super cool examples. And actually, I would like to dig a little bit into detail. So what's interesting is that since you're working in the banking sector, and that's one of the probably most data sensitive fields, I would say, and you are obviously working with LLMs. You mentioned DRAG, which is very promising technology of how to use LLMs based on your own data. So could you tell us what the challenges were for RAG, for instance?
Yes, absolutely. So we started this work very early. At the time, the cloud providers that we're normally using didn't have as many services and kind of guarantees that they will not share your data as they have now. So now it's much simpler. But at the time when we started, that wasn't really the case. So it was very important for us to define these cases such that they have value. So they have like real data that people actually use, but at the same time, the data is not super sensitive, right? So we wouldn't start with a case that, for example, contains information about a private customer. So instead, we started with internal instructions, regulations, and like things that are considered internal, for example, but there is no harm in exposing them to a third-party vendor because it's not like really critical for either business or privacy of the customers. And at the same time, the data is still important. So there is like huge amounts of it. And a lot of it is actually even contained on external websites. So for example, compliance regulations, there is like a huge set of websites that they just use on a daily basis. And you can use that as input to RAG as well. And the thinking that we had in mind at the time was that we need to start somewhere. We need to kind of build this culture of using these tools. We need to ourselves understand how this can actually be applied in practice. And gradually, as the tools develop, as the offering from cloud providers get better, and as they are able to provide us more kind of security guarantees and all of that, we'll be gradually able to grow these cases and add potentially more sensitive data as well, because we have a general strategy of moving data to the cloud in the long run, kind of independently of generative AI.
So this is actually very valuable information. So basically, the cloud providers that you're working with, they have been able to provide security guarantees that actually complies with the bank requirements.
So right now we're in the process, and this is really where my job ends as an innovation studio. But as an organization right now, we're in the process of getting the necessary approvals for this. But from the technical perspective, if you ask my recommendation, I think that's safe. Like that's good enough. But of course, it's not just my opinion, right? You also have like our colleagues from risks and compliance, and there is kind of this whole formal process that we need to go through, which is currently ongoing.
I see, because actually, so there's where the challenge is. I think so. Cloud providers have existed for some time now, even before the AI hype. And what I know is that banks are very restricted when it comes to using cloud providers, especially when it has to do with customers' data, because it's extremely sensitive. And actually, I know very few cases where it has been done, except, for instance, for a case like anti-money laundering, because if you do not really spend enough effort to detect that, you could be fined, for instance, by the US, and the fine is probably much bigger. So the risk of getting a fine is larger than the risk of the data leakage, basically, of private person. So there are some use cases that was justified financially, but I don't know about other use cases. So, I mean, in spite of your recommendations, and you see that there is no risk, what is at least your feeling when you talk even with other colleagues at other banks? What is the prevailing perspective when it comes to sharing your data on external cloud providers?
Yeah, I think, it's a very important problem because on the one hand, banks realize that this is the most promising way to go if you actually want to use state-of-the-art algorithms and like generally just be able to use your data at scale. And of course, it has challenges. So I probably shouldn't comment about other banks, but I can say that we have a long-term strategy of moving most of the data to the cloud. Now, that being said, there probably will be data sets that kind of never make it there, and that makes sense. But the overall strategy is to use cloud for like data analytics and AI and all those kind of things.
Would you say that's a huge step? I mean, just compared to 2 years ago, right?
We had it 2 years ago as well. So we were kind of, we started this whole transition to the cloud a few years back. So it wasn't really generative AI that was the reason. Like that started way before. But of course, it's a long-term process.
Wow. Okay. That's actually was a little bit of a news. I mean, I've heard from other people working at banks where, for instance, motivated the use of cloud services where it comes to cases like anti-money laundering, because that was strongly motivated. Super cool. Super cool.
Anti-money laundering is perhaps the trickiest case because that data is the most sensitive. And maybe in some cases, you're okay with using on-prem hardware if you have that. So probably shouldn't comment about specific data sets here, but...
So are there cases where you have been looking at on-prem hardware?
Yes. So back in my previous job, I actually worked in financial crime prevention. And at that time, we did pretty much everything on-prem. But that being said, that was a few years back. So I'm not exactly sure what the situation there now is.
I see. Cool. So you also mentioned about some work on modeling financial systems and the dynamics in these complex systems. Do you give us any concrete examples?
Yeah, so I'm personally very excited about trying to, and this is like a research and development project, so this is really far from kind of, being used tomorrow. But I'm personally excited about looking into how we can simulate financial markets with multi-agent systems, for example, just to kind of try to be able to do this modeling and prediction just based on that, because financial markets have one big problem that you have historical data, of course, but you kind of can't do counterfactual reasoning because all you have is just what actually happened. So being able to simulate that and model that and trying different strategies in a simulation environment, I think would be extremely interesting. But of course, it's a challenging research problem.
So actually, I don't know if you're familiar with this work on the AI that plays poker against humans.
No, I don't think so.
So actually, one of my podcast guests, actually a couple of them who worked on it, so Martin Schmidt, who was former employee at both IBM and DeepMind, they had developed the first AI that could play with multiple players in poker and actually did beat expert human players. That was called DeepStack. And now, recently, I think about 2 years ago, 2 years and a half, they started a fund, like an algo trading company. And they basically modeling the market as a game, it's multi-agent market. And they play this game to basically optimize their trading profits. So this actually, and it's based on counterfactual regret minimization, and I think it's very promising, but it sounds like you're not familiar with this work.
Not with the specific work. I mean, I know that people have been trying to do that for a long, long time. I just think that the problem is not solved, kind of, and it's in its full complexity, right? Because it's not just really about human behavior, it's also about all the external factors that are really tricky to model, because financial markets don't exist in isolation, right? They're being affected by all kinds of events that happen in the world in general, including geopolitics and all of those kind of things. So I think it's still an open problem, and it will probably be an open problem for a long while.
So what do you think? What is the approach to tackle this complexity? Especially that a lot of the macro stuff that happens typically maybe never happened before. It's not like you can look historically.
Exactly.
And, so how do you capture that?
Well, we're not doing that currently. I'm just trying to kind of formulate actually problems that we're going to focus on next. We're kind of in this process. So one thought that I have is that, and this is where large language models can help us, is essentially add in external data that is normally not being really taken into account in this kind of processes. So taking it from different sources, structuring it, represented in this some sort of maybe knowledge graphs or something like that, and really maybe trying to model different types of events and how those events affect each other and how that affects the development of the market.
So how would you model this relationship on how they affect each other if it's a new event that you never had before?
Yeah, so that's where domain knowledge, I think, comes in. So I'm not saying that it should be completely end-to-end AI. It should be an interactive system, and it should be a tool that supports human decision-making and not is making decisions for humans. So I kind of see it as really is reason and support, so to say. And so I think it can be a combination of extracting data from, say, unstructured text and like news data and things like that. And of course, adding domain knowledge and perhaps some priors as well. So kind of Bayesian style, like we wouldn't be talking about maybe probabilities, but maybe more about anticipated like probabilities of events affecting each other. So I'm not talking causal discovery here.
Interesting. All right, cool. So as an entrepreneur myself, so I always look for opportunities for even like other potential founders. So what are the opportunities for new ideas and potentially like new startups, products, services when it comes to AI in banking and finance?
Oh, if I knew that, I would have a startup now.
Well, or maybe you think, maybe you have some ideas that you don't think they are fun yourself, but think this could be really useful. I would really love to have this at work.
And that's a tricky one. I don't know. To be honest, that's actually one of the things that we can potentially do as an innovation studio. If we have a really good idea, we can actually create a new business model. That hasn't happened yet.
And what's the reason?
Well, because we haven't found that idea.
Okay, so it's hard. It's like you feel like it's a very tough business.
I think it's hard. I think it's really hard because if you think about traditional banking, a lot of this business is based on trust, which maybe as a new company, you kind of don't have by default, and you don't have your, you know, like your long-term relationships with your customers and clients and all that kind of stuff. So of course, it's probably easier to move fast from the technical perspective. It's easier to have your data on the cloud and all of that, but you also kind of lose something in that process. So you lose the maybe role that traditional banks are playing in the society.
I see, that's interesting. So when we look at the banking and financial industry, we see, I mean, now and then still new fintech companies coming up and solving some small problems, tweaking, etc. Is it like something that banks try to do themselves? So what's the reason that we see more and more fintech companies actually solving new problems? How come we don't see banks trying to go in some of these directions? Which is actually obvious answer is that it's typically you have an incumbent that is, you know, it's hard to change their legacy system, et cetera. That's an answer. But are there any other dimensions to that challenge?
I think it's, actually relatively recently in California, I met one fintech that I really liked and I asked them this exact question, like, what do you think your advantage is? And they said that, yeah, so it's difficult to do innovation in general in a traditional bank because of the legacy. You often don't have enough talent, perhaps, and they had a really good technical team. And it's kind of really difficult to make your business AI first when you're a very old company. Like, you kind of need to rethink many of the business processes you've had for a long while to be able to collect that data. And that can be really the key. Like, if you start collecting the right data from the beginning, it makes it much, much easier to use much newer technology.
But, I would say that, I mean, I fully agree, but couldn't, like, a bank think about, like, where you work in SCBX? And as you said, you have the mandate, actually, to take an idea and basically build a startup, whatever. So you can always hire talents. I would presume that banks actually got the money to hire talents, pay them. And this is exciting. This innovation, this is cutting edge. The bank has a lot of data and you can start to design your product in a way so you can actually collect data.
Yeah. And maybe that's what we will do.
Yeah.
We're also very new. So we've been around for a year only.
Yeah. So, essentially, it's not impossible to move in that direction.
Absolutely.
Right.
You kind of need a lot of factors here as well. So first of all, you need leadership that supports that, which we do, but many banks don't. And yeah, you just you kind of just need to do it, which is perhaps sometimes it's not the priority.
That's the thing. So that's, I think, the challenge for all companies, and that's having priority. There's always something that you need to fix with your current products. You need to think about your customers, but there is, you don't have this long-term view. It's not about what you're going to gain in 1 or 2 years, but it's probably you need to think long-term as 10 years. And that's actually how startups think.
Exactly. And I think that's, for many companies, that's maybe a leadership problem, which we are fortunate to not have. So our top management and the board are extremely forward-leaning when it comes to technology. But in other companies, that's often not the case.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm really excited to follow your journey at SEBx. And as you said, this is new. So we'll see what happens in at least 5 years. We need to give it some time to see. And actually, yeah, I'm personally excited about this kind of model. But of course, there needs to be real commitment from management. And that's definitely in terms of having a budget that supports project. Because at the end of the day, unfortunately, it's all about the money. You can't talk about talents, and especially in AI, where it's in such a hot market for AI talent, and you don't want to pay, then it's hard to get the talent.
It's not just about money, it's also about the structure.
I mean, the structure, absolutely. I mean, that's for sure. But let's not, you know, pretend that it's not about how to pay the talents, actually, to retain the talent. Because why? Because these talented people could just as well start their own startup.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
I just think there is more to it than just pay. So it's also about giving them freedom and mandate and actually enabling them to work on interesting problems.
Definitely.
Which is harder than just paying.
Definitely. That's actually one important dimension. But again, they would definitely, especially those who are more entrepreneurial, they would start their own company and they have really stakes in the company. So that's another type of payment. But that's actually, that's well established. If you look at Silicon Valley, you probably heard in the news how Elon Musk actually raising the compensation for AI engineers at Tesla because the competition is so harsh and he understands how the game works. So this classic, you know, way of pretending that doesn't matter, we offer you this, we offer you that, I don't think that's really works. I'm actually very straightforward with this thing because especially in Sweden where we live, we pretend as it doesn't matter.
No, I mean, of course it does matter. I'm just saying that it's by a long shot not enough. Like if you have a bad company culture.
Oh, definitely not. Definitely not. So that's what I'm saying. So you have the innovation, you have the vision, great. A place to be. But what I'm saying, at the end of the day, when we talk about talents, there is actually an additional part to it that we cannot pretend
it doesn't exist.
So that's, I think, very important. Cool. Now let's talk about some more fun stuff. Not necessarily more fun, but I like to talk about the most recent developments, and you're in the research field, right? So I guess you're always looking for, you know, new developments, new happening. So what are the new developments that are happening today that are catching your attention, that you're actually following up? I think this is exciting.
I'm very curious where the whole thing with reasoning for AI, and like especially with foundation models, is going to go. So it's maybe not the most recent paper, but I really love it, so I want to talk about it. It's Alpha Geometry from DeepMind that was released a few months back. So it's essentially a neurosymbolic system for solving international Olympiad level geometric problems. And it does really, really well compared to human performance. And it does so by combining formal methods with kind of using a foundation model to, as an oracle, to suggest you additional constructions in your geometric problem in the diagram. And I thought it was fantastic.
I agree. I mean, that was mind-blowing because this wasn't like just predictions. So geometry, and especially these Math Olympiad problems, for anyone who has tried to solve them, it's not like you can deduce results from looking at the given problem description. No, you need to imagine points and lines. So basically invent some new points and lines and circles in these figures in order to deduce results. So it has some flavor of imagination, intuition, which is, you know, things that we attribute to human. So it's not about something that the AI has seen. Now, we don't know. It still could be in a way that is trying different combinations of points and lines and circles given the figures. And since it's it has, you know, very efficient compute, it can go through them anyway and give you like a solution to the problem. But still, it's very impressive because this is something new. It's on a whole new level, and it's not something that is only baked in the AI algorithm, but also, as you said, it uses formal methods, so it's relying on something else. So that is really exciting. Do you think that by solving this type of problems, do you think that we are actually close to a reasoning system, or are we still more far from it?
I think we are. I mean, of course, you cannot directly apply that system to the general case, but I think it's a very important milestone in research on neurosymbolic reasoning. And I strongly believe that neurosymbolic reasoning is the way to go here, because just formal methods are not enough, and just deep learning is, you know, not enough if you actually want to do reasoning in safety critical systems, for example, if you want to have some level of explainability. So you kind of need to find this trade-off. And I think this paper in particular has a very healthy trade-off, because it uses a foundation model as an oracle to suggest you kind of this additional lines and points and so on.
That's super interesting. So do you believe that autonomous driving would be made with or without neurosymbolic reasoning?
That's an interesting question. Maybe. It depends on how much reasoning you actually need there. Like, if you need to coordinate fleets of cars, maybe you do. Maybe you're... I mean, it definitely should be some sort of... I'm a strong believer in combining classical computer science in general with machine learning. I don't believe in just doing deep learning end-to-end. So I don't know if it's going to be neurosymbolic or some other types of more traditional computer science approaches, but that should definitely be there.
Yeah, but you're basically saying some kind of deep learning with some kind of old-fashioned logic-based algorithms.
I think, yeah, especially for safety-critical applications, I think you need to have guarantees.
Yeah, that's super interesting. We will see. So when you think it's close, what do you mean by close here? Are we talking 1 year, 2 years, 5 years?
We're sort of close.
To have a reasoning AI system.
I said that it brings us closer.
Okay. So my question was, are we close?
We're getting closer, but I don't think we're close.
Okay.
I think it's still a very challenging problem.
Oh, so what is the time horizon?
10 years.
Okay, 10 years.
It's
all right.
Just a guess.
Oh, okay. So that's in my, at least the way I'm thinking, 10 years is much farther away. So when I say close, we're talking probably 2 years.
No, we're getting closer, but in research, it takes time.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, I agree with you. I don't think that, I mean, every time I get impressed and I think, oh, we are really close, I think. And then when you dig into the details, I don't want to be like, you know, this type of guy, all right, I thought it was this, but it was that. But it is actually like this.
I think
that it's very advanced and realize, okay. Because, so how do I typically think? I think, how does this solution generalize to more broader topics? And I realize, okay, this cannot generalize. So it still has its limitation.
Exactly. And I think there is something fundamentally missing in just using deep learning to, you know, try to address complex problems. I'm a strong believer in combinations of older methods with the power of deep learning.
That's super interesting. We will see what happens. There is actually a research group, and it's led by Joshua Benji, one of the godfathers of deep learning, and he believes that GFlow nets that he is developing, they are the way to reasoning.
Huh?
I mean, of course, you could be wrong, even if it's Joshua Benji. So even Albert Einstein was wrong. But I think it's interesting. And it's actually work that I'm following very closely. I still don't have any concrete idea about the potential, but I'm seeing that they are really solving interesting problems. So yeah, this is research that I'm following very closely. So Anastasia, we are getting close to the end of our episode, and I have one last question for you. And that's if you have any recommendation on a movie, series, documentary, or book with AI as a topic.
I think there is so much talk about AI today that it's kind of maybe good to come back to the basics a little bit and just, you know, read a classical textbook on machine learning by Chris Bishop and maybe a continuation of it that he published recently that is more about deep learning. So, yeah, a boring recommendation, but I think it's good to know the basics.
I think it's a great recommendation. It's a great book, actually. I still remember when I read it the first time, I was really excited from the content. He writes in a special way. It's very pedagogical. I think it's a great book. Thank you, Anastasia, for this recommendation. And thank you for being our guest in this episode. It has been a pleasure to talk AI and banking and finance and beyond with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye-bye.